She doesn't.
Why?
I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is Monday, February 9th. We're starting out with, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. Ms. Byerly, would you start this topic off for us, please?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. So this morning, will be the first of several meetings with the department because they have a very large agency with lots of programs and lots of budget information to share with you. In OLIS for today's meeting, you'll see a number of items. The first one is the agenda, which is also before you on a piece of paper. There is a presentation from the Legislative Fiscal Office that I will talk about real briefly, but I won't go through. It's a narrative document. It's got some data points for budget history as well as current budget. We've tried to, in that document, highlight for you, briefly describe some of the programs in the agency, highlight some of the current service level budget building components that are of note. I'm also going to some information we had used in preparing or working with the Joint Means co-chairs on their budget framework. These documents that you'll see from both DHS and the Oregon Health Authority will have several references to the governor's budget, since that was kind of the beginning point for some of that co-chair work. So you will see some references to some pieces of the governor's budget. There's a section in there to talk about some of the interim activities from the agency. They came before both the emergency board and interim joint ways and means committees and made several reports over the interim. There's a little bit of discussion about that, about some of the budget notes that they've been working on over this last year. That's to provide you some context for sort of what the conversation over the interim was, and some of these things will carry over into the conversations and discussions we had during this session. So that's kind of the gist of that document. You'll see a section in there for the whole agency as well as individual program sections. So that's something you can settle down with a cup of coffee and enjoy your leisure. The other things in the OLIS for you today, there's a PowerPoint presentation, a PDF document that the department will go through on the screen. There's also one from the Chief Financial Office, Department of Administrative Services, on the budget. And there are two other documents in there which are the bulk of the department's detailed presentation to you. So there's a couple of there's a ton of information in there. And if you would like, if you have questions about that, I can work with you on how to kind of extract the pieces. But we require all the agencies to bring forward several pieces of information as part of their presentation for this department because of the size and volume. To try and put that on a screen before you would be excruciating, I think, is the best word. So lots of material for you to look at. That is my remarks.
Thank you. I would like to spend just a moment talking about how meeting materials are presented on OLIS. What you see in front of us is the agenda, of course, the LFO presentation. That's Ms. Byerly, usually. Sometimes it's Ms. Ames. Under that is the DHS agency overview presentation. Under that is something called DHS DAS presentation. DAS presentation is generally what we used to call BAM, Budget and Management. Now it's Chief Fiscal
or Financial Office.
Financial.
Tamara, what's
Chief
the financial correct
office
title these days?
Chief Financial Office, Budget and Management Division. How's that?
Great.
You can say whatever
we're
going to
say.
Like.
CFO. BAM.
Yeah.
Okay. Everywhere where it says DAS, this is not another DAS agency presentation. It's always the routine financial office presentation that will come under that. We'll just have to get used to that. It will be repeated day after day after day. Just a reminder, what DAS means here is always the financial office perspective. Thank you. Are you ready?
Good morning.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the director of the Department of Human Services. Thank you so much for the time that you are about to spend looking in detail at our organization, what we've done in terms of the direction given to us from the legislature last long session in 2013, and also the conversations we anticipate having with you ongoing as our budget committee this session to build the next biennium's budget. My job here today is to give you a high-level overview of what you will hear in the coming weeks. You're going to go into a lot more detail program by program both in terms of what responsibilities or accountabilities that you've given to us to follow up with you on, some emerging trends and issues that we want to make you aware of, as well as some issues that the governor highlighted in his budget that he hopes you will talk about as part of the Department of Human Services budget making that you will do this session. We're available to you anytime to answer questions. We know that in committee on record, the presentations can sometimes feel very routine, and we also anticipate that you have a lot of questions that we're going to need to be able to work with you on, both individually and collectively as we go forward. So today is just an attempt to give you a broad overview of trends, who we are, what we've done, given your direction to us, and what we see coming up in the next biennium. So just a reminder, because some of you have served on this committee for many, many years, and we thank you for that and for your wisdom, and also for those of you who are new to the committee, welcome. We really appreciate your willingness to be part of our conversation. We believe that we do important work at the Department of Human Services. We help Oregonians in their effort to be safe, to be well, and to live as independently as possibly, and we do that through services that are designed to preserve dignity, empower choice, and also protect people. This is our mission. Around it in the circle, you can see our core values. We take those very seriously as an organization as we do our work. We provide direct services to over a million Oregonians every year at the Department of Human Services. Based on the last census data, that's almost one in four people in the state who benefit from the work that we do and the investment that taxpayers make in us. In the area of safety, we focus on issues like protection, prevention, both for adults who experience domestic violence, for children who experience abuse and neglect, and also for vulnerable adults, which in statute in Oregon is defined as people over 65, and as well as people with disabilities. In the area of stability and well-being, we provide cash assistance, food assistance. We help people keep their homes so that they can continue working and live full lives and be as independent as possible. And around the issue of independence, we've had a real focus the last couple of years on employment as the economy recovers, and also on issues relating to helping people with activities of daily living and things that they need to be able to live independently in their own homes and in communities for as long as they possibly can. Some of our services are temporary. Some of them are lifespan services, such as those we provide for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Some of our services are voluntary. Most of them are. People come to us in need of help and ask for our assistance. And some of our services are involuntary, meaning the law gives us the jurisdiction to go to them when something's occurring in their lives for purposes of protection. We know that the services that we offer that are not voluntary are very important and also highly intrusive, and we take our responsibilities in those areas and all areas very seriously. Our programs directly invest in local communities. We have a very large budget. Last biennium, the Department of Human Services budget was $9.3 billion total fund for the two-year period of time that we're in the middle of right now. We get return on that investment, both in terms of jobs, economic activity locally. It always is a good reminder to me of how important and complex the work is that we do to see that figure on your far right, the $9.8 million daily that our organization spends contractually in the form of benefits and services as we work to make people's lives better to fulfill that mission that we talked about earlier. We also look at the percentage of our budget on that far left. We want to make sure you know that goes straight out the door, that is not spent on anything that we do as a state agency. Nearly 80% of our dollars are going out in the form of benefits or contracted services to others who employ people, who provide job opportunities and provide services as well. Trends in Oregon that are impacting us right now. This is a slide that can take a little bit of time. I was fortunate in the House committee. Chair Kenny Geyer gave the department a little bit of extra time there to spend thinking about what these trends look like and what they really mean for us. In terms of the first trend that's listed on the slide, a faster population of older adults. The growth, Oregon population is growing generally, but the growth of those people who are 65 and older is actually outpacing the growth of our general population here in Oregon. As one of the organizations in the state committed to serving seniors, we're watching this trend really closely. People, not only do we have more people who are over the age of 65 and qualify for those services, but we also have people who, through the advancement of medical intervention and their own health and wellness, are able to live longer. This, we think, is both an opportunity for us in several of our program areas in terms of just the incredible assets that these individuals represent to us as a state. And it's also an important conversation for our budget as we look at the publicly funded services that this population may or may not be eligible for depending on their income and what that means for us in terms of our fiduciary responsibility as a state in DHS. In terms of increasing number of people with disabilities, again, this is an opportunity for us to help people live full and complete lives in community, and we really appreciate the opportunity that we have to do that. Just by way of statistics, in 2006, DHS and the Oregon Health Authority served about 50,000 people with disabilities under the age of 65 who qualified for our programs just by virtue of the fact that they experience a disability. In 2012, that number was 80,000 people for the year. So there's a significant jump between 06 and 2012, and that trend is continuing. For us, as I say, with the consumers, this represents a great opportunity to do our work well, to support them to live full lives in the community. It also represents a challenge in the sense that we're seeing more complex disability present in our programs. You're going to hear about that in several program areas, and this has an impact on our provider community. You're going to talk with us in a few days about the impact on turnover rates in our provider community that some of our rates and wages are contributing to. We see that ourselves in our own, some of the complexity and challenge in our own group homes that are state funded and state operated that we'll also be talking with you about. And Invoke Rehab, where we're looking to help people go to work. We're seeing the number of people with complex disability needs really go up, which then presents an additional challenge for us as we work with those individuals to live full lives and achieve the goals that they have for themselves. In terms of growing racial and ethnic diversity across the state, again, just by way of statistics, between 2002 and 2012, our racial and ethnic groups, people of color in this state, represented 34% of our state's population growth. Again, this really speaks to the need that we have as an organization to be agile, to be responsive, to make sure that our services are customized to meet the needs of those individuals we're serving, and are also representative of their culture, their language, and so that they can achieve the goals of safety, well-being, independence. It's also a great opportunity for us to have stronger and more diverse workforce as we do this work that then makes our performance better, and that's something that you're going to hear a little bit about from us that we're working on as well. And the uneven pace of economic recovery, especially in rural Oregon. The good news is we've been talking with this committee really for the last several biennia about the challenge of the economic recession. We've shown you lots of charts about the increase in our caseload. We are basically the safety net for the economy in a downturn, especially for those individuals who become unemployed or have never worked and who do not have unemployment insurance and then need help paying for food. Those individuals with children who then go to, unfortunately, slip into what qualifies as extreme poverty and end up in a position of needing our support, temporary assistance for needy families programs. The good news is we're starting to see caseload trends that represent a recovering economy, and we'll talk with you a little bit about that as we go through the presentation. We still have significant areas of challenge, however. Most of the jobs that are coming back in largely in the Portland metro area and in the Columbia River Gorge. There were just some stories last week about that uneven economic growth. We still have unemployment in some rural counties that are extremely high, not yet dipping down below pre-recession levels. And then that translates into some of the poverty statistics that you'll also be hearing from us. Statewide, our poverty rates in Oregon are right now about 16.7%. In some rural communities, poverty still exceeds over 20%. And at poverty rates among children are extremely high in the state. About 22% of children in Oregon experience poverty, which will be a conversation as we talk with you about the intersect between our programs and some of the early learning programs, some of the opportunities we see on the horizon for our department to support kindergarten readiness, to support quality childcare. Opportunities and challenge for sure, and something that you'll be seeing as we think about how we structure program to be sure we can be responsive to the different needs of the communities throughout the state. And also the jobs that are coming back. They are coming back. You'll see this in our caseloads, but they're also coming back. And people are either working in lower wage jobs or they're often receiving fewer hours, which then creates an overall income level that results in them qualifying for our programs. Some of the statistics from the Employment Department suggest that comparing 2013 to 2007, nearly 2.5 times as many Oregonians are working part-time right now. And that then contributes to their qualification for programs like the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program. The last data that we pulled on that program from about a year's time shows us that about 52% of individuals who receive those food benefits are working, 52%. Most of them are working in jobs, I shouldn't say most of them, but the average job at wage, let me repeat that, the average wage is a little bit over $12 an hour, but their hours are so low that they still have an annual income of less than 185% of the federal poverty level, which then means they qualify for those food benefits. So working people who perhaps would like to work more, but part-time work is what they're able to find. The next slide shows some of our caseload trends. As I just was talking about, the programs in our department that are largely responsive to the economy and that depend significantly on income for qualification, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, those are the two top charts. You can see their caseload history there. Their caseloads are just beginning to tip downward. In the 15-17 biennium for SNAP, for instance, we're projecting a 3.6% decline in the caseload. And again, we're really glad to see that caseload trending down to the degree that it represents Oregonians that are now earning enough to support themselves and their families. And in terms of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, you can see that we're starting to see a pretty good decline. And this is something we plan on talking to you about, because in the governor's budget, he does recommend that some of that savings from that forecasted decline in the TANF program be reinvested in the program to respond to some of the audit findings about the program, and also to be able to respond to that economic growth that's emerging so that we can better serve the consumers, the children, and the families that depend on that program. In the 15-17 biennium, there's almost a 12% decline projected for TANF, and we're looking forward to having that conversation with you. Where the caseloads are increasing should not be unexpected for those of you that served on this committee, and especially given those demographic trends we just mentioned, our aging and people with disability programs.
Excuse me. I don't know why they're all looking at me. This chronologically advantaged person who's been up here for some time.
Because we love, admire, and respect you, Senator.
Chronologically blessed.
Go ahead.
May I?
I think Representative Nathanson's co-chairing today.
Madam Chair, may I speak?
Yes.
I can? Thank you. God bless you. Okay, Aaron, okay, so are you going to come back then and kind of share with us what you just said about the 12% reduction? Is that what I got for TANF? I find that fascinating.
We're going to have in-depth presentations on each of these areas over the coming days.
Okay.
Aaron's in charge of the big picture overview of the entire department, right, but we have a number of days scheduled to dig into the details. Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson and Representative Olson. We are too. In terms of caseload growth, in our aging and people with disabilities and our developmental disabilities programs, we have seen more people, and we are seeing good news, again, more people living at home. So when you look at those caseload trends, the policy that this committee has laid out, that this body has laid out for our organization around emphasizing the ability for people to live at home with services is being carried out, and we are seeing good data trends in that regard. We also are seeing more utilization of the programs. The Community First Choice K-Plan option will be reviewed in depth in the, over the coming days around the Aging and People with Disability and Developmental Disabilities programs, and you'll see what that's meant for seniors as well as children in the Developmental Disability Program, which is where quite a bit of the caseload growth is on the DD side. And lastly, I just point to the child welfare caseload history. You as a policy body have been working with the agency to safely and equitably reduce the foster care population in the state for a few years now. I'm pleased to say that that is occurring. We are also seeing, when you look at, when you have that presentation, you will see other caseloads that are in the foster, that are part of that entire child welfare system, in-home caseload, foster care caseload, permanency caseload, adoption assistance, guardian assistance as well. And I know this has been an interest of the chair, and I do want to just report that our exits are exceeding our entries at this point, and we are seeing trends in the right direction around the ability of children to exit foster care since 2012. More of that is going on in a more timely way, and so we look forward to talking more with you about that in the child welfare presentation. The next two slides really are points of reference for you as we move forward. We always debate whether we should include them in the PowerPoint or have them just as a handout, but we include them just so they're, you know where to find them. They demonstrate for you the overlap in services in our adult and children and youth populations. This really is about the point I'll continue to make as you hear from us, that we have been really actively working as an organization to customize our approach with a focus on the need of the individual we're serving more than we're focusing on the programs themselves. The programs are important. They obviously have requirements and accountabilities to them. But when we look at the individuals that we're serving, and we know that more than half of them need more than one service from us, we've been really working on making that pivot as an organization so that our staff, our frontline workers, those that receive service from us, feel an approach from us that suggests that we're here to help. We have many things to offer, and we'd like to be sure we know the totality of their need as we're offering help, and we're not just focusing on whatever particular program we happen to be working for at that particular moment in time.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question? Can you provide us, when you get into to detail, because you do have so much overlap, you know, inside the agency, and also in looking at the various programs, there are different eligibility requirements. Somewhere in your presentation, can you actually provide us with kind of a one-cheater so that particularly some of the new members don't know that the eligibility requirements for SNAP, for example, may not be the same that you have with Voc Rehab. There is a lot of differential, if you will, between the various programs and services that you offer. If you could help us with since this chronologically advantaged group would like to have others to be in the same position that she's in, if you could provide us with those kinds of detailed information when you do your presentation, I would appreciate it.
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, we will follow up. What you'll hear in each presentation as will be the eligibility criteria for that particular program. What I also hear you requesting is like a one-pager that actually you can see that all of the programs in one place, and we have some of that that we can put together for you as well.
Because the gathering of the information to establish the eligibility will also be different as you look at the, you know, the criteria for each. So I think that would be helpful.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, we will do that. This also is just a reference point for you about our organization, how we do our work. As you all know, in 2011, the Department of Human Services that once included health programs became two organizations, the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. It's always just worth thinking about the five programs that remained in our department, which you will be hearing from, the Intellectual and Developmental Disability Services Program, the Aging and People with disability program, child welfare programs, self-sufficiency programs, and vocational rehabilitative services. Those are the programs within the purview of DHS. As I'll mention later on, however, we do work very closely with the Oregon Health Authority. We share administrative infrastructure with the Oregon Health Authority. When the two agencies were created, this body gave direction to the department to do that in a budget-neutral way, and so the Department of Human Services has a body of administrative work that we do in service to the Oregon Health Authority. The Oregon Health Authority has the Office of Information Systems, OIS, our technology department sits there but is in service to DHS. If you recall, this was planful with a purpose, with consultation from outside expertise. We will be talking with you about that as we go along with the program, but a review of all of our programs, but just a reminder of that, of how things have to come together. Also on this chart, I always like to emphasize that far left, which is our service delivery component. Everything that is elsewhere on that organizational chart is oriented to our consumer and a shared customer goal, including all of our business operations. This has been something that we've been doing with intention the last several years to make sure that people working in contracts, people working in HR, can talk about the overarching customer goal that we're trying to achieve and see their work in alignment with it. So the front line of service delivery, and not all of that service delivery that's on this chart, includes people who work for entities other than the state, because we felt it was important to represent to you the continuum of service that is out there, and it's not all of it. I mean, we have hundreds of contractors and others who provide services as well, but we wanted to make sure that those basic building blocks of service infrastructure were represented for you here, and there are local government and nonprofits represented on that left-hand side because they represent such big pieces of the service delivery continuum for that particular body of work. In developmental disability services, for example, the direct service the state provides is to children around case management and also to adults that are in group homes that require an extraordinary amount of care. But everything in between that is really driven by services by what are called brokerages, support service brokerages, and also by our county developmental disability programs. And so there are contracted partners who provide the vast majority of service, but there's such an important piece of that continuum. We list them here so you can be sure to know what that structure looks like.
This is Kelly Seal. Do you have an estimate of how many people or organizations DHS contracts with? It's beyond the dozens. It must be the hundreds, perhaps more.
Co-Chair Nathanson, I want to get the exact number for you. I know it's over 200, and it's many. We have been looking at that really closely because one of our major initiatives is around performance-based contracting, and we've been doing a count of how many contracts specifically so that we can consider the percentage of those that we have that are performance-based. We also work with some individuals as what are called Medicaid providers that are not technically contracts. Many of our programs, most of our programs are federally driven, and that's a federal construct within Medicaid around the Medicaid provider qualification. We can get you that information as well.
Thank you. I think it will be very interesting to hear a little bit more about that. On a previous slide, there was the number 78%, I think, of what happens through DHS happens through the local communities. It's not state government directly providing the service. It's through other providers. And so having a picture of how many providers that is all around the state in all of the 36 counties, I think, will be helpful. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erin, where in this, under delivery, does the child care come?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone. On this chart, when you look at those... if you look at the self-sufficiency programs, that is the program area that administers the employment-related daycare program. We don't actually have the child care providers listed here. They showed up on an earlier slide, the slide that had the 78% that Representative Nathanson talked about. They're represented among that 27,000 providers that we directly subsidize in terms of wages. So they're not 27,000 employment-related daycare. That also includes in-home providers. So we will get you the exact number of how many providers providers currently are working in employment-related daycare, but they're not listed here in the org chart for delivery. As you might imagine, we were working on trying to make a really complex set of systems fit onto a page in an org chart that might make sense. We could go on, and we have other layers of it, but thank you for the question. We'll get you that number.
Yes.
Thank you. Erin, is the self-sufficiency director position still vacant? And if so, what is your timeline for filling that?
We have narrowed down the applications. Yes, I'm sorry, Representative Nathanson and Representative Kenny Geyer. It is still vacant. It just became vacant in November. We had an open recruitment. People have applied. We've narrowed that down, and we're in the process of working with stakeholders to create an interview panel to narrow from what usually is anywhere between 5 to 10 top candidates down to a top three that then have to go through another round of interviews that are pretty intensive. We have a pretty inclusive and intensive process for filling those positions. And so we would hope to have somebody within the next 30 to 60 days, if we could, at least have been made an offer. But we certainly have had the experience before where we go through that entire process, and if we can't find the right person, we need to keep looking. So. The next chart is, for me, a little bit of a description. We've talked about our services, our consumers. This is really about the way that we do our work and the progress we've been targeting as an organization between two constructs, really. Sort of from whence we came in terms of ways that we've operated in the past around, you know, really being organized as separate divisions and programs with very separate missions and visions about what our goals that are that we're trying to achieve, to working on a vision of ourselves as a single department with a mission and a set of goals where we leverage program specialties. This isn't about undoing the fact that some people work for us who really care deeply about working in a particular area, but it's really about making sure that consumer focus happens in a way that leverages across the department.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kelly Seal, this is probably one of the best slides, I mean, most reassuring and makes me happy slides I've seen in a while, because it's exactly, I think, what we've all been hoping for. I don't know that you're going to necessarily be able to say right this minute, but as you go along over the next week and over the course of this session, I personally would appreciate hearing where you think you are in the process of getting to where we're going on each of these things, and what your barriers are, and how this committee and others of us in the legislature can help take down those barriers. Because I think most of us would agree that where we are going is exactly where we should be going, and we need to get you there as fast as humanly possible. So if there are specific things we can do to help, I hope you'll let us know. More of a statement than a question.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you. That's actually a great segue. I do have a little preview of that in the next couple of slides.
Great.
And maybe I'll just jump to that because you all can reference this later as we go. But so let me talk about some of the things that we've done. I'm sorry, Senator Winters.
Just, Madam Chair. Just quickly, not to follow up on that, but on where we're going on the integrated and coordinated data and eligibility, and I don't know whether it's somewhere else in the presentation, but would you also, because you have a fraud unit that exists when individuals, you know, have not been forthright and honest. Is that going to be somewhere in your presentation? Because I'm well aware that we've funded your unit and expanded the number of staff, and that does exist inside of your bailiwick. Will that be a part of your eligibility and technical services?
Representative Nathanson, Senator Winters, we will talk about that, particularly as we review the conversation about our self-sufficiency programs, although it has relevance in our Medicaid programs as well, and I'll make sure that they're ready to comment a little bit about what that means in their program areas. And we also have a recommendation in the governor's budget to expand the ability of those fraud investigators to actually reduce caseloads so that they can do their work in partnership with law enforcement and in response to concerns that are raised in a more timely and responsive way. So we will be talking about that as we move forward.
Thank you.
This next piece is just a little bit of a reflection about some of the good things that are happening and where we're focusing, and then there's a slide directly following about the challenges and that Senator Steiner Hayward asked us to speak to. For the last 3 years, we've been working throughout the organization to implement a performance management system to track outcomes on a quarterly basis, not just across the whole agency and across programs. This looks at our performance outcomes as well as our process measures. We get together as a leadership team, an expanded leadership team, every quarter and do this. But we've also cascaded this management system down throughout the organization. We call them tiers. All this is to say that one of the places where I feel like we've made quite a bit of progress in the last couple of years is around issues regarding our ability to be data-driven, to be more proactive, to know when challenges are arising within the organization and be able to problem solve and respond to those, to be more accountable with each other about where we're struggling. And then what happens as we do that as an enterprise is we are able to talk about problems as a collective. So when we look at the issue, let's say, around timeliness of investigations, and we look at that from a collective standpoint, we can see where in the organization we may be having success and where we may be having more challenge, and we can target our efforts and our resources accordingly to the challenge, and the collective of the executive leadership is aware and can speak knowledgeably about one part of the organization or another and the opportunities and the challenges that exist there. We've been looking at data by race, ethnicity in these quarterly target reviews. And we've really also been working very hard to ensure in many ways that this is about sort of a bottom-up and a top-down approach to this. As you all know, back in 2008, the agency started to implement the Lean Daily Management System throughout the organization. That's been an ongoing effort, and the result of it is that our frontline staff identify challenges in business process, they identify opportunities and how they would like to streamline or resolve those challenges, and then we roll those up. Sometimes that's within a work unit and it's something they can solve on their own. Sometimes it's a proposal that will have statewide impact and it's something that takes us a little bit longer to implement because we want to have some of our work be very consistent as people interact with us as an organization. But what's going on now in terms of our maturity around this performance management system is we're really trying to marry the conversations that are happening around that frontline work with the conversation about process and performance outcomes at the central office level. This is a tough process because not all of the this also includes conversations with our counties and our brokerages because they're the frontline work in some of our systems, and it includes conversations with our local offices as well. So I would say we're in varying degrees of progress around that ability to marry that frontline to the quarterly business reviews that are happening at all the way the enterprise of DHS level, but it's been a very intentional, purposeful effort, and I think it's starting to yield some pretty significant results. With managers recently who were talking about the data that they're using to measure and track, which is a very different conversation than I was having with them 4 years ago. They're talking about data across programs that they're using to measure and track, changes that they're implementing, support that they're giving to other program areas to make those changes, even above in their own program areas and program needs, because that's a place in the organization that's struggling and we need to concentrate our energy there. So shifting the culture quite a bit for the organization, and I think we've seen that happening. Where we have work ongoing that we're very focused on in the coming biennia as an organization in terms of our own performance and our work, we continue to want to emphasize the strengthening of our work around customer service. This has been a focus. We, for the first time, now have quarterly customer surveys that give us feedback about how we're doing. We have quarterly provider surveys that we review. Actually, I think that one's either semi-annual or annual. I have to look at the round for that. We didn't want to bother them every quarter. But we hear back from our providers about how are we doing back on this metric over here about we want to be a collaborative community and business partner, and so how are we doing? We have places where we're doing well. We have places where we're not doing so well. So how do we get better? We really wanted to have, we're working on identifying how strategically to go at this issue of customizing our approach and becoming more consumer-driven. So that's a big focus. The issue around collaborative results-oriented business partnerships, we've had a very intentional focus on performance-based contracting, some of that legislatively directed, some of it internally driven as well. This, to be done correctly, this is something that's happening nationally with many organizations. To be done correctly with as many community partners and business partners that we have. We really have to do that collaboratively. We need to engage with our business partners about what the outcomes are that we think we should be achieving. It's not always obvious, candidly, especially if you're working on something that's a holistic outcome for a consumer. If your organization is dedicated to well-being and several other organizations work with that individual on their well-being, who gets the credit for that in a performance-based contracting situation? So we've been engaging with our provider community, and we will be doing more of that in the next couple of years to ensure that we can create contracting opportunities that do a couple of things. One, give you and we as an organization a better sense of the outcomes, not just the outputs that are the result of our contracts. But also, we hope in this process to be able to streamline some of the reporting requirements and to be able to take advantage of this as an opportunity to create focus on the right things wherever possible and less busy work and process wherever we can streamline that. Our goal for our staff and our goal for the staff that we support others to have is to be able to spend less time on the bureaucracy and more time with people. We know we're failing. You'll hear about that in some areas right now, but it's a concentrated effort and we're working on continuous improvement in that respect. We also know we're succeeding in other places. So in an organization this large, we have a lot of variability and we'll be prepared to talk to you about that as we go.
Ms. Kelly Seal. A few years ago, the legislature passed a bill asking DHS to work at not only within DHS agencies, but also with the Youth Authority and others to reduce duplicate audits, as you just said, the busy work, the paperwork, processes that weren't necessary. When we asked for a report on that, close to a year later, the work had not yet started, although the bill had already been passed. Would you please be prepared to let us know through a subsequent memo in a few days, or maybe when your agency comes back to report to us on general business functions, how many of those duplicate audits you actually eliminated since the bill passed in 2011?
Coach Nathanson, sure. We have a different process now for those audit and ongoing reviews, and we'll be happy to get you more information on that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes. Not a question, just a comment, and it supports what Kelly just suggested or mentioned about focusing on what to do the right things. And I got to tell you, her agency has really worked hard, especially in the public assistance programs for program integrity. You'll see a number of bills that we're going to be moving forward and, you know, listening to in the session, but it deals with that, and I really appreciate their support. But it's just been really, you know, fun to work with them too.
Madam Coacher,
yes.
Just quickly, and Erin, you might want to just briefly make a comment on some work that I ask you and OIA and others to do on data and those alignments that you're meeting offline. I want to thank them because this is work that I, and we always add something to their plate, and so this is one that I added to their plate and trying to get at the duplication of effort that goes on. It's because we recognize that probably sometimes the family that she has in DHS will end up in OIA and will end up in DOC. So I've asked those agencies to come together to try to help us. So go ahead, Erin.
Coach Nathanson, Senator Winters, thank you for the opportunity. This is a really exciting body of work. So it gets back to this issue of using data to better inform the work that we do. And I want to emphasize that that's happening across the department, but also outside the department with other agencies as well. We've been doing a lot of work to protect privacy and also pull data out of antiquated systems, match data, so that we can create a framework for the ability to better identify and anticipate where we might have the opportunity to prevent some of those higher costs need for services down the road, whether that's in corrections, in juvenile justice, or in the foster care system. We've been looking at what happens in the lives of youth. We're looking forward soon to looking at what was going on in their family environment when that's happening, and we have some really smart people that are doing a lot of analysis of data to be able to come back to you all and to the leadership in the organizations to say, when it comes to return on investment, when you look at 10 years of data, What are some of the trends that we saw? Where were some of the opportunities to have intervened, and where on the go forward will that be possible to occur? So we're really looking forward to that work product coming to full fruition. It's been making a lot of progress. We've been accountable to the senator as we go. And there is a policy package the governor's budget supported that is specifically in the DHS budget, but is really about all agencies. And it's about the conversation Senator Steiner Hayward's committee has been having over the interim. Senate Bill 450 passed last legislative session. There's been a task force looking at how we can share data around two different bodies of work. If I get this wrong, Senator, please correct me, but there's first the work that happens directly with the consumer and how what opportunities might we have where people voluntarily would like more coordination, more ability for governmental entities to work with their families in a more collaborative, communicative way. And then there's work at the aggregate level, which is a lot like the work we're doing already at Senator Winter's request, to work across agencies to better anticipate, analyze, and provide information to all of you. There's a policy package in the governor's budget that talks about growing what is called our enterprise analytic capacity. It's a really fancy word for getting you better information, getting us better information across agencies, including education, housing, employment, corrections, OIA. So even though it sits in the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, it could go anywhere. That recommendation, you'll hear more about why it ended up where it is, but it is part of the budget conversation coming up.
And colleagues, just to add, we recently added Department of Ed to the discussion, as well as my last meeting with the group of the Secretary of State's office, because you get into the performance audits and what have you. And I just have to say, I'm very kudos to those directors who have all come and sat down and to work on this particular issue. You know, and they're doing it without having to have legislation. And it's so I just want to thank you and Colette and others who have sat at the table with me to move forward on this issue.
Thank you, Senator. The last two around staff competency and effectiveness. This is really during the recession, we reduced a lot of our programming and services and focused quite a bit on crisis management. And as we're implementing transformed systems, different ways of working, as we're looking to engage consumers differently, as we're working with provider communities differently, what's become really clear is that our staff have a real drive and desire to do the work differently. They need the tools to be able to do that. And so we have a focus around aligning and really getting current in our opportunities to train and advance the competencies and capabilities of our own staff internally, staff and leadership in the organization. And of course, we're always looking for ways to improve the efficiency of our utilization of resources and have been working internally on structures to improve our ability to do that. And we're going to continue to focus on that area of continuous improvement and opportunities to get better in the go forward. Trying to keep us moving here, I apologize. Our greatest challenges and there are quite a few. Technology has been referenced already, and it's something that we know we will spend time with this committee on and also with other committees on as well. We happen to have systems that depend on very old technology. You all made some investments in us to try and address that. Some of that did not come to fruition as we had hoped it might. Some of it is moving forward, and some of it had to move forward really quickly and is now in conflict with some business process that we need to continue to streamline and work on. So there's quite a bit of conversation that we anticipate having around technology. Technology, I believe, is an important conversation with you all for a couple of reasons. I think right now we have providers, we have staff that constantly are working against technology to do their work, and we'd like to change that. And we also have an opportunity, I think, with technology to be able to rededicate time to people as opposed to the processes. And so I hope we can continue that conversation, obviously, in a smart, thoughtful, deliberative way. the pace of change. This has been a real challenge over the last couple of years. In a couple of areas, change was directed and implemented almost immediately coming into the biennium in such a way that we have this really stark contrast within the organization that I'll point to. We have differential response, where we first implemented the community supports that were needed out in the community, and now we're implementing the enhanced practice model. We retrained everyone in the basic practice model, and we're slowly and purposefully engaging communities around implementation of that model. And it's taking time. Sometimes, much to my own frustration, it's not going as, you know, fast enough, but the folks that are doing this work are saying to me, if you would like behavior change, adaptive change, you need to give us the time that it takes to get the courts on board, the attorneys on board, the communities on board, everybody in place, so that we're keeping families safe, children safe, while we're implementing this new model. So we have that model of change, which is happening at a very intentional pace. And then we have other change that needed to happen instantaneously in the system. The K-Plan Community First Choice option, for example, was one that the legislature asked us to bring online right as the biennium started, to be able to fully leverage the federal resource to be able to expand services and increase rates, which were all really good things. But in the implementation effort, we had to implement quite a bit of change before we trained, before we engaged, and now we're going through the training and engagement, and it's been painful, and rightly so. The communities that we're working with on some of that implementation have been very frustrated with us as an organization, and it has been frustrating for us as an organization. But I think what keeps bringing us together is that commitment to the consumer. And the good news is around that issue of pace of change, what you will see is that we've seen so far just yeoman's effort on the part of the serving community and the agency to make sure that consumers continue to see the benefit even while the infrastructure is struggling with the pace of change. So it's just a real dynamic in several of our systems, and it'll play out differently in different programs as you talk with us about it. Federal issues and drivers, we have a few days in the committee dedicated to this because it's become a very pronounced challenge for us as an organization. We work really hard here in Oregon to make sure that whatever federal change comes our way, we do what we can to organize it, if you will, to make sure that here in Oregon we're implementing it in such a way that makes sense and is consistent with you all as our policymakers and directors. We also, though, have a pretty active federal body right now, both in terms of the administration and the Congress in several of our program areas, and we're going to talk about that and what that means for program administration. Oftentimes, because of that shared federal-state program relationship, those instructions and new requirements come down with no new resources and lots of new responsibility. And so we want to make sure that you know what those are and can understand how they're impacting us and, therefore, most importantly, how they're impacting our consumers. Getting equitable results, this has been a real challenge for us. We've been working on this with intention. I'm happy to say that we have, you know, more contracts with culturally specific providers. We are doing more work to be more accessible as an organization. And I'm also, I am also needing to report to you that we have a lot more work to do. We have a lot more work to do around accessibility for our deaf and hard of hearing community. We have a lot more work to do around getting, undoing some of the disparities that are in some of our systems. We're obviously working within a larger context around many of these issues, most of these issues, the unemployment data that I was citing earlier, as we're working with communities of color, their unemployment rates are much, much higher than that of the rest of the state. And as we're working to get jobs and employment and we're serving people in our programs, and that's a real focus, we're working within that larger economic context for those communities as well. But we've identified things that we need to do to eliminate institutional racism and reduce bias, to improve training, to improve our contracting processes and to track data and be more accountable. But this has been tough for us, and we're not making as much progress as I wish I could tell you that we are, but we are making some. It's just very, very slow.
This issue is not an issue that you should bear alone. And I need to put that on record when you talk about the institutional issue. I appreciate the agency actually working on it, but it's one that you won't be working by yourself. because when you start in other areas, and I had a reporter call me that we've been tracking out of Multnomah County with housing and what have you, some of the issues there. I mean, clearly, this is an issue as a state that we've got to grapple with. You know, you and I have had this conversation before when we look at the disproportionality, you know, both in your agency as well as DOC, as well as OIA, and I can go on because education has some of the same issues. So I just want you to know that I appreciate the work that you're doing, and it's work that has to occur within inside of all of our institutions.
Thank you, Senator.
Committee, I'm doing a time check. I note that we're on slide number 12 of 34 for Ms. Kelly Seals' presentation, and following that, we do have another one from the Chief Financial Office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move more quickly. Of the rest that's here, I think one of the things I just want to mention is this issue around provider capacity, and then I will go more quickly as we go here. I just want to acknowledge that there is a lot of stress and strain in our provider community. Right now, we have expanded the amount of revenue available to provide service and increased the demand for service. But at the same time, we also have a provider community that's working really hard to catch up with that. And they're also working in an environment where I know you'll be hearing about wages and the issue of wages and its impact on turnover. And so this is really important to us around safety and our conversations about consumers and just a conversation we anticipate having. It's also an issue within our department as well, but it's something that in this system, as we're working to continue to do more with less, which has been our trajectory for the last decade or more, we just want to keep on the table for you all as we think about the increasing expectations for performance and accountability, and also then the challenge of just meeting those expectations as a community. So I'll keep moving. I'm going to just give you a quick highlights, and you will go much deeper into these as the presentations go on. So I'll try to be really focus my energy in the right places. Safety for children is a main goal of ours. We primarily provide responsive services as it relates to safety. That's what we're most known for. When you take a look at our budget, I think given the time and attention that's paid to child welfare, obviously a very critical service, but it's about 9 to 10% of our total budget. But we also do other things that have impact on the safety of children. Family stability obviously impacts the safety of children, and we provide children's services to children who receive intellectual and developmental disability supports as well. We've done quite a few things in the last couple of years. With your support and direction, I've talked a little bit already about differential response and community support, as well as competency and capacity of staff. We have a new abuse reporting hotline. We have a new foster care ombudsman who is actively working with youth in foster care who call to help manage and resolve issues. And we have implemented the Foster Care Bill of Rights, which was a cooperative effort with foster parents to make sure that that legislation could happen in a way that was respectful both of the drive for the legislation on the foster youth side and also the foster parents who are trying to do the right thing. We've expanded services to children with intellectual and developmental disabilities living at home. Quite a bit of expansion happened there as a result of the Community First Choice option, which we hear from families on a regular basis is helping keep their families whole and together, which is a really amazing thing. And we did secure a Title IV-E waiver, which as we reduce foster care will give the state permission to keep the federal dollars that would have been associated with our foster care had we not had the reduction. It's a very complex financial model. Lois Day plans on talking with you a little bit about it in the phase one, and if you want to keep talking about it in phase two, we can do that as well. What's coming up? We have more work to do around differential response. We've got a lot of implementation going on in child welfare. What you'll see was recommended in the governor's budget for the child welfare arena was really stay the course. Help us to stay on track with the investments in staff and community resources that are allowing the kind of positive change that we're seeing in the system. We also have investment in community programs that serve kids in the budget, and we will be implementing a new assessment tool for children and youth with IDD, and that will require training and capacity throughout the state as well. For adults, safety for adults, there's a lot going on. The legislature has been very involved in the issue of vulnerable adult abuse and also domestic violence. We look forward to more of those conversations this session. This is just a high-level list of some of those things that have happened. We have enhanced background checks. I know Representative Nathanson wants to continue a conversation about how we continue to streamline that process to ensure protection. We also have other people in the legislature looking for a conversation about some of the never-never crimes that have been passed that are now impacting employment for people who are desiring to provide service. So this is a rich issue for policy making and discussion. And thank you for the support you've been giving us so far to have the conversation around the Adult Protective Services system of technology that's still in the planning stages and will be before you. Maybe we go to what's next on the next slide, Eric, please. So that we can think about what we can do in terms of technology to better support that group of staff who work for the state and for our AAA partners. Currently, those staff, for the most part, use paper to track their work, and we'd like to bring them into the 21st century.
Chair?
Yes.
Could you please tell me what AAA is?
I'm sorry, Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer. This is an area agency on aging, and in the next couple of days, you will get more of a tutorial on that. We have different types, but we have we share responsibility, particularly around the Medicaid eligibility and adult protective services work, with local counties or community governments, councils of government that form into type B AAAs of different types. And also statewide, we have area agencies on aging that provide really important preventive services, food and nutrition services, Oregon Project Independence that are called type A AAAs. So I'll just give you that brief teaser and you can look forward to more coming your way.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to keep us moving. Independence. There's been a lot of work going on here. I've already talked quite a bit about the community first choice option. You're going to hear outcomes from both programs that show more people living at home in community, which is really great for Oregon and for those individuals and for their families. We have partnerships going on with coordinated care organizations to have some shared accountability for outcomes, particularly around medically fragile persons with disabilities and also seniors. We know that some of the drivers into our Medicaid long-term care system can often include health events, and we're working actively with the healthcare system, both on issues around prevention to try and keep people healthy longer so they maybe don't decline as precipitously, don't require Medicaid intervention, but also when someone does have a health event, a broken hip, whatever might have transpired, to make sure that we're working together to try and put that get that person home as quickly as possible and with the right kind of service to help them be healthy. I should mention family-to-family networks in the individual and developmental disabilities arena. This is an important community-based array of family support for families with children and youth who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. You all made an investment in them to grow the number of them and the capacity statewide to serve, and they do important work to help families leverage natural supports and ultimately reduce the cost on the publicly funded system so that they can be independent in their homes with their children. What's next? You've given us a charge around a pilot project to expand Oregon Project Independence to serve not just seniors but also people with disabilities. We are very, very early in the initiation of that work, but we will have a report for you, probably not phase one, but coming up soon to give you a sense of how that's going. We do have people enrolled in the program, but to be able to tell you what's happening around that enrollment, we want to get a little further in the process with them. Caregiver training, expansion of the home care commission registry to also include private pay. This is all work that's underway in terms of infrastructure to expand access to in-home supports for all Oregonians. And I do want to mention in this arena, we have a targeted work that we do in Medicaid for those that qualify for the Medicaid program, but we also have quite an expansive amount of work that we do for all Oregonians who might have an interest or want to know more about their options as they age and what's available to them. You'll be talking a lot about some of the recommended investments here. We have a day coming up just on Department of Labor. Obviously, that's a policy coming from the federal government that is currently in a little bit of a state of flux, but we've been working hard to get you very current information on where that is, and we'll be bringing that to you this week. And we have some expanded provider capacity around that complex group of folks with needs who happen to have intellectual and developmental disabilities in the budget. employment, lots going on around employment. We want to make sure that the populations that we're serving inside the department benefit from the recovery that is ongoing. We know in past recoveries, sometimes those we serve get left behind. And we're really working hard to be at tables locally and at the state level so that the populations that we're serving are benefiting from things like sector strategies and the local workforce investment board's focus there so that TANF recipients or recipients, people with disabilities, have the opportunity to be part of that conversation. We have active work going on around people with intellectual and developmental disabilities through our Employment First initiative, having opportunity to work in integrated community settings. So lots going on for us, and you'll see as we start to report out on outcomes that we're starting to see the fruit of that in our programs. What's next? Ongoing work around workforce system alignment. I'll be in front of the Senate this afternoon talking a little bit about that with our workforce system partners. There is a new federal law called the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act that is driving, quite frankly, just reinforcing a lot of the work already underway here in Oregon to align both around customers and contracts, our work as a workforce system. And we're doing quite a bit of that right now. And we have more work to do to continue our efforts to get people with intellectual and developmental disabilities employed. We really look forward to a pretty broad and extended conversation both with the policy committee and with you all as a budget committee about TANF redesign and what that program needs to look like to be different, to do to address things like the benefits cliff and also around employment-related daycare and how that program comes alongside families who are working to be able to allow them to continue to work. Again, there's new federal legislation around child care that we need to talk to you about as well. And improving customer service. This we've talked quite a bit about already. I just want to mention that there are three things that we'll be talking more with you about. I talked about the enterprise analytics. We've talked, we haven't talked yet about the race, ethnicity, and language. This is a conversation that's been going on with the legislature for the last couple of years. A bill was passed directing not just our agency, but also the Oregon Health Authority to do a better job of collecting and gathering information so that you can have, consumers can have, the ability to have to self-identify in ways that are more broad than we currently allow, and then we can track that in a way that's more common across programs so that when we're comparing data, it's apples to apples and we're not having consumers show up in one category in one program and in another category in another. And we would like to have a conversation with you about non-MAGI Medicaid eligibility automation. There's you'll be talking with the Oregon Health Authority about their work to stand up their MAGI Medicaid automation tool, their Kentucky transfer system, if this is ringing a bell for anyone. There is another body of work that we do on the DHS side that involves consumers who are aging or who have disabilities that is still Medicaid eligibility work, and we'd like to talk about continuing to invest in the technology that supports automating those systems so that we can have less complexity and more time with people. I think it's important to also emphasize for you that we're part of these other statewide transformations, and they're not all listed here. I should probably have something up here about housing and the work that's going on around affordable housing, because that's become a major issue for our work and our ability to achieve outcomes. But this just gives you a sense. We're at all of these tables at the state level and locally, and within each program presentation, they're going to give you some specific examples of what that looks like for them, whether that's the Reentry Council and conversation about prisoners who are aging and also people who are coming back into community from prison and our role in that, or whether that's early learning hubs and the fact that we're sitting at tables making sure there's alignment between the work we do with differential response, child welfare, TANF, ERDC, and our early learning partners, and wanting to make sure that we have shared accountability for those outcomes around system alignment. Overall, how are we doing? This is just a high-level view of what is a much deeper scorecard, but these are sort of the what some of our outcome metrics are showing us right now. In child safety, we have areas where we are very, very green, and then we have a trend going on in terms of foster care and abuse and care that we're watching really closely. And so that one thing has tipped us over into yellow as compared to some of the other things we're watching, which are all going in the green direction. So we just are being really transparent about that. The adult safety is trending green. We're doing much, much better coming from behind in terms of overdue reports and investigations and assessments, and really getting the word out about financial abuse in a way that we're hoping will begin to see that trend that's currently increasing begin to go down. And good work happening with our licensed care providers as well around opportunities to strengthen and improve quality. The next two are, you know, we're hitting our targets, and we keep changing the targets to increase our expectations. It's just a place where we're really seeing a lot of good work right now and seeing the fruit of that. Customer satisfaction. Our last survey had about 75% of our customers saying that they got good or excellent service from us. We would like to see that be much higher. But for us, that's where we're hitting right now, and we're in the yellow. Service equity getting better, but still, I mentioned earlier, we've targeted some of our hardest to serve populations as our starting point for some of our work around service equity, and moving that dial is taking a very long time. And agency efficiency and operations, always work to do there. You know, in an agency this size, I would look forward to the day I could come in and tell you we're green, but we're always discovering opportunities to get better. So I think yellow is probably where we're going to be for a while as we keep on this work together. So with that, I'm going to let Eric give you the high-level budget overview.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? Ms. Kelly Seal, thank you so much for this thorough presentation. I have been holding back asking this question, and I'm a little reluctant to ask it. But how hindered are you by the lack of well-integrated data systems?
Representative Nathanson, Senator Steiner-Hayward. I think the real issue around this for us is time. And I had mentioned that earlier as a challenge, and I had purposefully bookended it. There are two things that occur. I think with regard to consumers on the front end, which is always where we want to start, we are working really hard with schools, with other organizations that we partner with, to enter into data sharing agreements that continue to protect consumer information but that allow us to serve people better. I think it takes our teams a lot of time, not just to put those agreements together, but then to navigate the complexities of what that means for people on the ground. And that time can cost people things like services that often are life-saving. And so that, where we are finding opportunity to be able to do that, especially when people's lives depend on it, we are working very hard to do that. And the opportunity cost is time. I would say that in the aggregate, the same thing really is hugely a constraint. We only have so many people in our data shop who work on these issues. And data historically for agencies has been spit out in the form of reports. And as we've been digging into this issue, the reports we get aren't even necessarily the data we need to manage, and they certainly don't go across programs. And so it requires time to be able to take that data, analyze it, and make it into something we can use so that we can tell you how we're doing on an outcomes basis, not just an output or throughput basis. I also, after the last 2 years, have quite a bit of caution around this issue of interoperability and, you know, going too far, too fast. Obviously, we have had the negative experience of that, but I also point to my partners at the Employment Department who, because they were less interoperable, actually protected security and privacy better than they would have if they were more interoperable. And so, for me, this is a really complex issue, and I think we need to talk about the human time that it's taking and the cost of the time versus also then what we can do tangibly around overcoming some of these interoperability barriers. And I think we've learned a lot. Never waste a crisis. Always an opportunity. And I hope we apply those lessons as we talk to you about the next two-year increment of change on this issue. We've not given up on the vision that we will be able to serve people better because we can use our data more effectively and take less time to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Eric Moore, the Chief Financial Officer for Department of Human Services. I'm going to briefly go through the next four slides. You can see on the first slide, our governor's budget is just over $10 billion. And this pie graph shows where in the agency each of those total funds exists. On the next slide, it's depicted to show where the money goes, and about 94% of our dollars are in direct payments and services. So this is the direct payments that Ms. Kelly Seal mentioned earlier that go directly out the door, and for our people and partners that are actually providing the direct services. So that's 94% of our budget. On the next slide, it's representing 68% of our funds are federal funds, so we greatly leverage our federal partner funding. However, that also means we are subject to their restrictions on and limitations on spending those funds. You see a large portion, about 27% of our budget is general fund. Much of that is used to match federal funds or for maintenance of effort purposes for a variety of our grant programs. Our other funds are about 5%. Again, some of those, a big chunk of those resources are used to match federal funds in order to draw down those federal funds.
I'd like to emphasize what you just said, particularly because we're a new committee and not all of us have been on this particular subcommittee before. I think it's real important to note what you just said, that the federal funds, it's not just money that automatically comes to Oregon. Some people call it block grant or grant. It doesn't automatically come. Could you say one more time what you mean about drawing down funds and matching? If we spend money, then the federal government invests in Oregon also. And if we don't spend that dollar, the federal dollar doesn't come. Could you just say a bit more about that?
Representative Nathanson, thank you for the question. I just want to say one thing and then also go back because I saw some confusion about another point. So in our Medicaid programs, for instance, in order to bring in the federal Medicaid money, the state must invest. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is actually opportunity, particularly in our APD and our DD programs, to get even more investment than we had been in the past. And I'll let Mr. Moore talk to you about the match rate. There are also block-granted programs like the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which is a block of money that has come to the state. It's not a matching program, but it comes with the constraint, a requirement that the state spend general fund at a certain particular level, that's what we call maintenance of effort, in order to qualify for the block grant dollars, and you have to spend that money on certain things. So I wanted to give that high-level overview and also just go back to the slide before where we went from 78% to 94% and explain that, just because I saw some question marks. The 78% is in the two, in the green and the orange, the direct payment to providers and the direct payment to clients. We add to that the direct services. So what we are wanting to show you is the difference between the folks who are directly touching clients' lives, which is in that 16%, which is dark blue, and then differentiate those individuals that are directly serving people from what otherwise people traditionally consider to be administration, the people that work in our central office. So we have about a 6% administrative overhead, those of us that work for DHS but don't serve clients directly, and 4% of that actually goes over to DAS in the form of statewide assessments and charges. And so really within DHS, because we know we're large, we have about 7,500 employees, but the employees that work in the central administration headquarters represent really about 1.5 to 2% of that. We also have additional admin responsibility in our state charges, and we benefit obviously from the services DAS provides. But the other 94% is really touching a client directly. That still may be state staff, but they're directly serving people. So I just wanted to give that clarification, and then I'll let Eric circle back to the match and MOE issue, if that's okay.
Thank you.
So, members of the committee, I think Ms. Kelly Seal and Representative Nathanson pretty well covered what MO and match is. So match, again, being general fund dollars that we need to use to draw down and pull down those federal funds. So for every dollar that we spend in general fund, we may get $1.65 or so in federal funds. And if we don't spend the dollar in general fund, we don't get the dollar in federal funds. So it's not, they're not fungible dollars. It probably is most notably in our SNAP program, where it's a little bit different. Our supplemental nutrition assistance program is 100% federally funded. The benefit itself is 100% federally funded, but to administer the program, we have a 50-50 match, which means for every dollar we spend on administration, they will provide a dollar for administration. For maintenance of effort, we have programs like the TANF program, where we have to spend upwards of $96 million a year in order to draw down those TANF federal funds, and we have to spend it on certain specific items in order for it to count as maintenance of effort.
Thank you.
On the last budget slide, and we tried to keep it short on to not bore you on the budget slides, is really just showing the difference between the current legislatively approved budget and the governor's budget in each of the fund types.
Okay.
And I just appreciate the time. I do want to emphasize that we will go into a lot more detail around all of this. I know some of this was just a very high-level introduction. What you see here are some themes that you're going to hear us repeating. We've got a lot going on that we'd like to work with you to continue to finish. We've got a lot of many federal drivers that are impacting our conversation for the next biennium. All of this drives us to a conversation about priorities, and we know you have more than just our organization and our budget to prioritize around, so we appreciate that and want to work with you to get that done. And then just as we will give you a brief glimpse into the next few days of schedule at each day so that you can see what's coming up next. And tomorrow and the next day you'll be hearing from our Aging and People with Disabilities programs and go deeper into some of the issues and budgets in that program area.
Thank you. Just quickly, a request, when you do the administration detail, give us some trend lines on your DOJ budget. We've talked about it, and whether or not you should, you know, some in-house versus, or how we can lower the cost for you. So if you will kind of give us some trends as how that's working for you, it would be appreciated.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Winters, we will do that. Thank you.
You have presented us with a huge amount of information, and you obviously have a wonderful perspective and can see the big picture as well as all the many, many details. I appreciate your being here with us. I know you can't be here with us the whole time every day, but I feel confident that you and the people who will be presenting are listening to all our questions and will follow up. I appreciate all the work that you and others in the department did to put this presentation together.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
We have maybe 5 minutes.
She told me I could take the whole time.
It's really up to you if you want to hear from me. Eric, thank you very much for doing that. I appreciate it. First of all, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm a new face to you probably from the Chief Financial Office, Kate Nass. It used to be the analyst for this, and we kind of mix assignments around and so that we can continue to keep learning about the new agencies. And so I'm just going to actually talk to you very briefly about the priorities for the governor and putting this budget together. And quite frankly, it was about priorities for outcomes in programs rather than just funding programs for funding program's sake and continuing the standard budget growth. And so we, when we were putting the budget together, we had to limit growth in certain areas in order to make sure that we could continue to invest in areas of what we felt were innovation and areas that the legislature started, especially, for example, differential response and the strengthening and preserving and unifying families, wanted to continue those investments because growth was so high. In other areas of the agency, especially in caseload, we needed to ensure that we could pay for caseload. And so this slide is just a quick slide that shows you kind of the growth, that this is still a growth budget. DHS has significant growth, especially in caseload areas. And then the next slide is somewhat of another mix on the how many dollars go out directly out the door to providers versus how much it stays in-house. And Director Kelly Seale really explained this well. The DHS employee costs and services and supplies, they do figure a percentage of their employees who have direct contact with clients in the payments out the door. So in the way that the CFO's office just categorizes expenditures, we had 83% going out the door and then 17% in DHS employee costs, not just administrative overhead. It's also direct service providers and services and supplies is about 17%. So you can see the vast majority of their dollars are literally going out the door to individuals and other organizations. And then I'm not going to go deeply into this, but the governor's priorities, again, were to make sure that we could fully implement differential response and the strengthening and preserving and reunifying families. TANF redesign is especially is a big priority. Expanding employment-related daycare is also important to the governor's budget process. And then continuing and expanding opportunities for employment for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities was important in order to kind of continue implementing the employment first initiative, so to speak, and then continuing the community first choice option plan, also known as the K plan. And then you have a slide, you have some slides, I'm not going to go over them, that show other investments that were made, targeted investments to achieve certain results. And then quite lengthy, the last slide just shows you that the governor's budget is $2.7 billion in general fund for this agency. And the co-chair's budget framework, while it does identify some priorities for what it would like to fund in DHS, overall in the program area, the goal for the co-chair's framework is to cut $140 million more from the is $140 million less than what the governor's budget provides. And that's spread out between the program area, which, of course, you understand includes the health authority and other agencies that are before this committee. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Hopefully that was fast.
that was the Cliff Notes version.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Ms. Byerly?
I'm going to close the public hearing for today. See you next time. Thank you. You're adjourned. Somebody can see you. Next time. Thank you. You're adjourned. Somebody can see you.